Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by the Foundation at Hearst Castle, where donors and members experience exclusive events that recreate what it was like to be a guest of William Randolph Hearst, from swimming in the iconic Neptune Pool to dining in Hearst's private guest house overlooking the Pacific Ocean. The Foundation at Hearst Castle's ongoing mission is to support the conservation and restoration of Hearst Castle while offering youth programs for underserved students. Discover how you can become a member by going to foundationathearstcastle.com and learn how you can support this unique and invaluable mission.
Alcatraz Federal Penitentiary Guard George DiVincenzi served on the Rock from 1950 to 1958, just 5 years before the island prison closed its cell doors forever in 1963. George and I sat down for a visit in the old prison hospital, directly across the corridor from where he long ago played checkers with the infamous Birdman of Alcatraz. I'm Tom Wilmer. Come along and join San Francisco native George DiVincenzi as he recalls his life on the Rock.
George DiVincenzi?
George, you were a guard at Alcatraz.
That's right. I got here in 1950, and I left about 1958.
So you did some time on the Rock.
Yes, I did.
We were talking earlier, we're mutual friends with a former guard.
That's right. Frank Heaney. Yes, absolutely.
He was the youngest guard in the history.
That's right. I believe he was 21. I think I was 23.
So you were the old man.
That's right.
Tell us about your time on the Rock. What comes to mind first when you...
I was born and raised in San Francisco, and when the war ended, I was overseas. And there was 15 million servicemen returning home after the war. It was extremely difficult to get employment, so I started taking civil service examinations, federal, state, city, county, and I took this one on the Lark just to see what it would be like. When I was a young boy growing up in San Francisco, I used to fish and sell newspapers and, believe it or not, shine shoes along the waterfront. And I could recall I used to put nickels and dimes in the telescopes to look at Alcatraz. I was always intrigued with it, being born and raised here.
It was very mysterious to you, I bet.
That's right. So to make a long story short, I took the examination and they called me right away. And I said, I got a great opportunity. My God.
You alluded to World War II. You were too young to be in the service.
No, I joined the Navy when I was 17 years old.
Really?
Yeah. When I come home, I was only 20 years old.
Were you shipboard during the war?
Yes, I was. I was aboard the heavy cruiser. They took me off of that and dropped me off on Guam, and I was stuck there for about 15 months overseas on Guam.
That was after...
During and after the war, yes.
So after they dropped the bombs, you
were
stuck?
That's right. I was overseas when they dropped the bomb.
So you didn't get home until 46 then, right?
June the 5th, 1946, I got home. Anyway, I took that examination and they called me right away. So I came over here and got a thorough examination that lasted all day by all the high officials on Alcatraz. I figured, well, that was the end of that. But they always had trouble maintaining personnel here, continuous understaffed. So I think it was less than a month they called me right away for an interview. I came to Alcatraz and spent all day, got thoroughly interviewed by all officials. And within a month, they asked me to go get a physical exam. And I began to figure, by golly, I may be going to work over there. So right away they called me, they wanted to know when I wanted to come to work. So I went through 4 weeks of very extensive training here. It was excellent, I must admit. They kept us steady all day long for 4 straight weeks. Upon completion, they told me to take the weekend off and come back the following Monday morning at 9 o'clock.
I'm going out of sequence, but I want to go back to when you were a little kid and you were so enchanted by Alcatraz that you had put a quarter or a nickel in the little telescopes.
That's right.
To stare out there. Yeah. Did you ever... imagine you'd be on the Rock?
Never in a million years that I ever thought I'd be working here. And like I said before, I was a young kid, maybe 14, 15, selling newspapers, shining shoes, and fishing all along the waterfront. And I was always intrigued at the general public looking at Alcatraz through telescopes. So naturally, I used to do that myself. Where do we go from here?
Well, now you're on the Rock. You just got hired. You're in the barber shop.
That's right. 9 o'clock that first Monday, it was my first assignment, my first day at 9 o'clock, and the barber proceeded to cut his first customer's hair. While he was doing this, they were talking in low whispers, and I thought that was odd. The tempo of the conversation got a little bit higher, a little bit higher, and next thing you know, I began to get very suspicious. Just then, the customer who was getting his hair cut jumps out of the chair, and the barber goes after him with a pair of 7-inch barber shears. He gets him in the heart, in the throat, in the lungs, and me, like a damn fool, blowing a whistle trying to separate him. We spun around, knocked a second barber's chair over. He cut my leg accidentally, 10 inches, big gash on my leg, cut my new pants and my new shoes.
This is your first morning of work.
9:15 in the morning. Well, I ended up on top of him while he kept stabbing him with the shears. Obviously, he was on his way out. He ended up lying in a large 3-foot-wide pool of blood. And I'm standing there holding the scissors. How I got him, I don't recall. And a very strange thing happened. He went down and kissed him and said, "I love you." That was my introduction to Alcatraz.
As the guy's dying.
He was gone, yes. Immediately the FBI came here, two of them, came within the hour. They brought me into the warden's office, and I had explained everything what happened. Then we proceeded to go to the barbershop, and I had to go through the whole routine. And there was a cabinet in the barbershop that I had never seen before because I had just gotten there at 9 o'clock. We proceeded to check that cabinet out, and it was a large stack of towels, about a foot high, and on the bottom, covered, was a piece of glass 12 to 15 inches long, and as a handle, he had wrapped two of his white socks, prison socks, with rubber bands as a handle. So one way or another, he was going to kill this guy. That was my first murder.
Very first morning. That's the first quarter hour.
That's right.
Yeah. Do you think that you were unwittingly a part of this? They knew a new guard was going to be there?
No, it was a homosexual affair, and God knows how long and what was going on, I'll never know.
So just luck of the draw.
Yeah.
And then there's something that most people don't know. You were not armed.
Oh, absolutely not.
Yeah.
You're never armed around inmates. They'll take it away from you. The only officers that are armed are in the gun towers and in the gun galleries, looking down upon the inmates. Those are the only officers that are armed. When you look at these TV movies and you see these guards walking around with 2-foot-long wooden clubs and guns, that's all Hollywood. They take them away from you, and then what? They got them.
What other things are outstanding in your memory?
Five years later, I got promoted. I was classified as a senior officer. Consequently, I got more responsible positions like the kitchen, the clothing room, isolation, cell house officer, more important jobs working with inmates. I came in one morning and I was told that I was the acting lieutenant for the day. Apparently the lieutenant got sick or something. I said, okay, fine, I know what to do. They told me to go to segregation over in D block, where isolation and segregation is, to get an inmate out of his cell and get him to turn back into the general population. If I remember correctly, he was there about 2 to 2.5 years to protect his life. An inmate was after him. The so-called inmate, Govin, we got him out of his cell. I had two officers with me, and we brought him down into the clothing room to take a shower and get him outfitted to be turned back into the general population. That's a normal procedure. He took us, removed his clothes, and as he was stepping into the shower, this so-called inmate who was after him 2.5 years prior was working down there. He had a knife, a shiv, secreted somewhere down in the clothing room. Before we knew it, he went after him. He was stepping into the shower naked, and he went after him and butchered him up with this knife. That was my second murder. I sometimes wonder, why am I working here, you know?
It happened so fast, there's nothing you could do.
Nothing you can do, no. Well, I got a lot of stories about the Martin Sobel.
He was a spy, wasn't he?
Spy, yeah. He was a co-conspirator with the Rosenbergs, who were executed in New York for espionage. I never liked the guy myself. Later, roughly 5 years ago, he was given 30 years. They could not get enough information and evidence to give him the death penalty, so they gave him 30 years and right from the courts to Alcatraz. I never liked him because of anyone who would do that. Here I am, an ex-veteran from being in the service, and I'm watching this guy giving atomic bomb secrets to Russia. I got a little bit of a story on him. You want to hear it? His wife used to fly out once a month from New York, and you only allow one visitor per month. So she would come out like the 31st of one month, stay overnight in San Francisco, and come back the first day of the next month so she can visit 2 days in a row. Legal. Well, I used to be the East End officer down there, and while she was talking to Martin Sobel, she used to expose her breast to him. And being a good officer, doing my job very thoroughly to observe everything that took place within her hearing, I had to observe all this. I revealed this to the general public about 15, 16 years ago, and it got quite a write-up in the papers, and he was asked this question. He readily admitted it was true.
As I remember talking with a fellow guard, Franchini, years ago, I remember he talked about the Birdman of Alcatraz being here when you guys were here, and he did not like him at all. He said the Birdman was not a nice person.
I had the Birdman, Robert Stroud, for approximately 18 months in the hospital. I believe I know him as well as anybody, if not more than most. I had him on three different shifts, and I hate to admit this, but I used to play checkers with him. Not all the time. The only time I would play checkers with Robert Stroud, and right at the end of the hall, there's a gun port up there, and the officer in that gun gallery could look down and see and observe if the officer was okay. And here I am playing checkers with Robert Stroud. The only time I would do this, if I knew that officer and I trusted him. If I didn't know him too well, I would never do this because that would be automatic dismissal. He was the highest celebrated case. When I first got to Alcatraz, the first 6 months of my duty on Saturday was to go to the hospital with another officer, two of us. And we would lock everybody else up in the hospital. The food orderlies, the janitors, everybody. That was the warden's requirement. Before you let Robert Stroud out of the cell, everyone else had to be locked up. The highest celebrated case. He wasn't going to do anything.
No.
What could he do? Mm-hmm. Locked up in the second floor of the hospital, bars everywhere. Where could he go? But I used to give him a lock razor. A lock razor is such that it requires a little Allen wrench to remove the blade. And I would give him a fresh blade. He would shave his face, shave his head, and shave his whole body. Sometimes I would have to remove the blade and replace it. And after that, he would get in the tub in the next room that we just passed that tub. He would take a hot bath in there. And this would start around 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, and go for an hour and a half to accomplish this. Well, after he was laying in that tub, I used to say, Robert, get out of there. I got to go to lunch. It's 11, 11:30. He used to say, oh, please give me a few more minutes, please. So I would go ahead and let him do that. Then we would get him out of the tub, dress him up, and lock him back in his cell. And while I was doing this, the other officer would be going thoroughly searching his room. Actually, it was a ward that could hold four beds. and he had the whole ward to himself with two beds. This would be about 11:30, and then we'd lock him up, and that would consume my morning on a Saturday. Then I can go to lunch.
You were here at Alcatraz through 1957.
Yeah.
Then what happened? Why did you leave?
Well, I began to hear more and more rumors about Alcatraz closing. 50% of the people said it would close. The other 50% said it'll be here forever. But if Alcatraz closed, I'd have to go back to Kansas or Missouri or Atlanta, Georgia, or God knows where else. But being from San Francisco, I couldn't see myself going there. So I started looking around very thoroughly, and I was lucky to make a contact in the United States Customs Service. It took me 2 years. I was able to transfer. The warden Swope refused to let me go when Customs wanted me. He was very upset. In fact, he got so mad that he wrote a letter to the Customs Service and said, "Stop trying to take my personnel away." Well, he retired, and Mr. Madigan, his successor, was a great man and knew what I went through originally 2 years prior. He said, "If you could arrange it, I will release you." So back to Customs I go, and it took, like I said, 2 years. They took me, and he released me, and I went to United States Customs and put 36 more years there. So with my Navy time, my Alcatraz time, and the Customs time, I retired with 46 years.
What do you do now, the fun things you like to do?
Well, I'm very active at Alcatraz. I wrote a book. The name of the book is Murders on Alcatraz. I pulled that out of the air because of the two murders that I just described. And it took me many years. I didn't want to do this, but my family kept after me. And everyone that I worked with knew me. He says, "Write a book, write a book. You got some great stories." So I finally did it. And I'm here one day a week selling this book. And it's very successful.
Big hit on the rock. Now, I bet the kids love talking to you.
Yeah, they get a kick out of it, I guess.
For a listener that wanted to get your book, could they purchase it on Amazon?
Yes, I get a check about once a month from Amazon.
The name of the book? And
Murders on Alcatraz.
And the author's name?
George DeVincenzi. I started out by ordering 500, 500, 500. Then I ordered 1,000. Then I ordered a second 1,000. Then I ordered the 3,000. And I just ordered the 4,000.
Best seller. I love it.
Thank you.
George, thank you so much for sharing. What an honor.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by the Foundation at Hearst Castle, where donors and members experience exclusive events that recreate what it was like to be a guest of William Randolph Hearst, from swimming in the iconic Neptune Pool to dining in Hearst's private guesthouse overlooking the Pacific Ocean. The Foundation at Hearst Castle's ongoing mission is to support the conservation and restoration of Hearst Castle while offering youth programs for underserved students, preserving the past and inspiring future generations of dreamers. These children experience a world of science, technology, engineering, art, and math at Hearst Castle, STEAM, along with studying the legacy of Julia Morgan, one of the most important women in the history of engineering and architecture. The foundation at Hearst Castle not only changes the lives of children, but also provides lifetime memories and unrivaled experiences for our generous donors and members. Discover how you can become a member by going to foundation@hearstcastle.com and learn how you can support this unique and invaluable mission. You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
This is Roseanne Cash, and I'm sitting here with Tom Wilmer. Please support your local NPR station.